This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. Hello, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming to you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. And we are so excited about the guest we have here tonight. This is one of these stories of the lost corners of history that when you hear it, you are not going to believe it. So without further ado, let me introduce my guest, Scott Stern. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're the author of a book, The Trials of Nina McCall, Sex, Surveillance, and the Decades-Long Government Plan to Imprison Promiscuous Women. That's quite a title.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of all there in the title. It's a huge program that not many people have heard of.
So first question of what sparked your interest in this subject? What made you decide to write this book before we get into the meat of the book?
Sure. So when I was a freshman in college, I took a class called Media, Medicine, and Modern America. And the professor was talking about how hard it was for the government to treat sexually transmitted infections, syphilis and gonorrhea, in the early 20th century. And the professor said, you know, these were so stigmatized that as late as 1934, the U.S. Surgeon General couldn't say the word syphilis on the radio. And the one way that authorities were able to talk about these infections and thus do something about them was through the campaign to combat the supposed scourge of prostitution. And almost as an afterthought, the professor added, during World War I, there were even concentration camps for prostitutes in this country. And that phrase totally struck me. It took me off guard. I had never heard of that. So I took a break from taking notes and I did some Googling and I didn't find much online. And I looked on Wikipedia and I didn't find anything. So I decided I would have to look into that. And that became my very short paper for that class. And then it became basically every other paper I wrote in college and then graduate school. And then I decided to turn it into a book. I thought somebody should really, you know, more people should know about this system in which some women actually did use the phrase concentration camp to describe their incarceration.
All right. So what is this system? It's what was referred to at the time as the American Plan. What was the gist of this? You're not going to believe those guys when you hear it, but, you know, what was the gist of this?
Basically, from the 1910s through the 1950s, and in some places into the 1960s and 1970s, the U.S. government locked tens, probably hundreds of thousands of women in what some women did call concentration camps because authorities suspected that these women had sexually transmitted infections, syphilis or gonorrhea. The way that the American plan worked is that government agents would walk down the street and any woman whom they quote unquote reasonably suspected of having an STI, they could detain her, have her forcibly examined, usually by a male physician. And this was a time when there were not routine gynecological exams for most women. And if she tested positive at a time when the false positive rate could be as high as 25%, a woman might be locked up without due process, so no trial, no hearing, nothing, in a detention hospital or a reformatory, basically a penal institution. And she would remain there for weeks or for months, again, with no kind of trial. And the purpose of having her there was to treat her for the STI that authorities claimed that she had. But until the advent of antibiotics in the 1940s, there were very few effective treatments for syphilis or gonorrhea. So the most common treatment was injections of mercury and the ingestion of arsenic-based drugs, which, as you may guess, won't cure you of anything, but will kill you and in the process hurt a tremendous amount. So again, tens, probably hundreds of thousands of women were locked up without due process under this program, the American Plan, that so few of us have ever heard of.
And what was some of the things that might make you be suspect of possibly having an STI at the time?
Yeah,
so covered some things.
Yeah, the standard was reasonable suspicion, which is very vague. It's a legal standard. And it allows authorities to detain pretty much anyone they want. So I found examples in the archives of reasonable suspicion being a woman walking down the street alone, a woman walking down the street with a man, a woman sitting at a restaurant alone, a woman sitting at a restaurant with a man, a woman drinking alcohol, a woman being with a man drinking alcohol, a woman buying a wedding dress. And the examples really do go on. It was anything the authorities wanted. And sometimes it was even that a woman had jilted a cop or a health officer. I found a number of examples in the archives of health officers basically saying to women, have sex with me or I'll have you locked up under this program. And some women were locked up because of that.
Wow, that's just astounding that, you know, this happened here. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, it's been going on for quite some time. Like, I know you said it started during World War I, but there was a resurgence of this during World War II as well, right?
That's right. That's right. This was, you know, this was a national program during World War I, but the federal government knew that they were going to lose funding at the end of World War I. So they urged every single state to pass their own laws, enabling local authorities to continue to do this. And so by the early 1920s, every single state and hundreds of cities had passed their own American plan laws. And under those laws, officials continued enforcing this in the 20s, the 30s, and the 40s. During World War II, it was kind of reinvigorated, as you said, at the federal level, and then funding once again stopped when World War II ended. But because of these local laws, the American plan continued to be enforced in many places in the 50s, 60s, and even into the 70s.
Wow, so that's not that long ago, really, that this was still happening here in this country.
That's right.
And what kinds of women usually were they targeting?
Yeah, they were disproportionately, almost exclusively targeting working class women. These were not educated women who were getting locked up. And in the very few examples when educated women were locked up, there was usually a big scandal. And disproportionately, they were targeting women of color. This played really well into horribly racist stereotypes at the time that said that black or brown women were more promiscuous or even, according to some of the more ludicrous stereotypes, somehow anatomically more likely to contract, transmit STIs. And, you know, this was connected to a whole bunch of other racist programs in the 20th century. A lot of people have heard of the Tuskegee syphilis study, where the government let poor black men die of syphilis and helped to facilitate their deaths from the 1930s to the 1970s. By making sure that these men didn't get treatment and actively misleading them. And what no one who's written about Tuskegee has ever written about is that every single one of the administrators who oversaw Tuskegee at the federal level had gotten their start enforcing the American plan decades earlier.
Wow. Yeah, that's definitely shows a pattern of actions that was going on there.
Totally.
And I know one of the things that you had said happened was that sometimes these women were forced to be sterilized while they were in these facilities.
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, this was a time when there was a very dominant eugenic philosophy. So those people in charge, the quote unquote elite, the well-educated, the people with money and the people with power, believed that they were inherently better than certain other people. And so when women with sexually transmitted infections, some of whom sold sex, were locked up under the American plan, they would usually be given a sort of rudimentary IQ test, what was called the Stanford-Binet test. And if women tested below a quote-unquote mental age of about 12, they could be classified as feeble-minded. And if they were classified as feeble-minded, sometimes they would be sterilized. So I found numbers of examples in the archives of women who had done nothing wrong other than have a sexually transmitted infection and then get a low score on a rudimentary IQ test. And because of that, they might be sterilized and have the ability to control their own reproductive choices permanently taken away from them in kind of the most unthinkable way possible.
And these women were subject to torture while they were in these facilities. These were not just a healthcare facility. They were torturous for them.
Yeah, the punishments in American plan facilities were really pretty cruel. Women could be beaten, and then there were more kind of draconian punishments, like women could have their heads shaved. They could be injected with chemicals that nauseated them. They could be doused with freezing water. They could be suspended by their arms. The list of kind of fucked up things that happen to women in these institutions just goes on and on. And it was a way of controlling women, but it was also a way for powerful people to exert their dominance. This program was quite literally the patriarchy striking back.
And, you know, this all sounds very draconian, but, you know, it sounds like something out of Handmaid's Tale, you might think, but this was all happening right here in this country. And unfortunately, not that long ago, these laws, like you say, are still on the books, and they tried to use some of these laws not that long ago at the beginning of the AIDS epidemic, correct?
Yeah, that's right. I think what a lot of people forget about the mid-1980s is that as straight people realized that they too could get HIV, there was a huge amount of hysteria. And there were mass calls for massive quarantine and for mandatory testing. A poll taken in December of 1985 found that a majority of Americans favored some form of quarantine. And, you know, there were a number of times when authorities called for some form of quarantine. And when they did that, they would sometimes invoke the still existing American plan laws that were still on the books. And in the, you know, some 25 states did pass laws specifically adding AIDS to the list of diseases that merited quarantine. And there were a handful of cases of quarantine that did happen, mostly of sex workers who were deemed, quote unquote, recalcitrant. And when those people who were quarantined sued to try to win their freedom, the courts would always strike down their challenges by citing American plan precedent from decades earlier. So this is not ancient history. This was happening in the 80s and the 90s. There was no mass effort to quarantine people as happened under the American plan, but there still was this specter, this ability of authorities to threaten people with that tool.
And as he said, that these things are still on the book. After I started reading about this, I decided to look up the New Jersey laws about quarantining people. And it's you can look it up yourself. It's section 26.4-36. Persons who may be quarantined for venereal disease has the purpose of preventing transmission of venereal disease and shall mean and include restriction of actions, behavior, movements of a person, or confinement to a defined place or area. A local board of health officer or physician shall report to the State Department or any licensed health officer or the authorized representative of either may quarantine for venereal disease the following persons. Any person who is believed upon reasonable grounds to have a venereal disease in its infectious stage. If he is likely to spread the disease to others by failure of refusal to submit to treatment or by reason of his habits. And here's the kicker, or for any other reason. This is currently the law in New Jersey, or for any other reason. So
that's right, and if you look up the history of that law, you know, it's an amended form of a law that was passed in probably 1918 or 1919. And I mean, there are instances in public health policy where quarantine might be merited if there's some sort of terrifying disease that is so infectious that if you're just like in the same room as someone else, they might get it and they might die. You could think maybe quarantine could possibly in some form be valid. But with a sexually transmitted infection, it just makes no sense. You are not going to cough and give someone syphilis. You know, we know that, and we've known that for centuries. This is not about controlling some sort of terribly infectious disease. This is about controlling people's sexual behavior and only certain people's sexually behavior.
Yeah, this is not, you know, this is not Ebola we're talking about here. You get a sexually transmitted infection only from having sex. I mean, that's kind of how they work. I know at the time they did have some confusion, but
yeah, but not that much confusion. They've known since at least the 19th century and mostly earlier that, you know, you couldn't get STIs by shaking hands or by coughing or by kissing. You can get certain STIs, but not syphilis or gonorrhea in that manner. And people knew that. But again, you know, this was about controlling women, and it was about controlling poor women and black and brown women. And it was based on stigma, and it was based on stereotypes, and it was based on misogyny. And sadly, that philosophy still endures to this day.
Oh, yeah. We see, you know, constantly the current power systems are trying to remove women's body autonomy from them in various attacks across the country. So this is not an alien, you know, it almost sounds too eerily like it could happen again at any point in time. And one of the things I thought that came out of my reading was a lot of these women actually did manage to fight back, even though in a time when it was so oppressive for women, there were women that did manage to stand up for themselves, either through going to court or some women even rioted in these facilities. Could you go into that a little bit?
Yeah. So one of the most inspiring things that I found when I was researching this book, and one of the things that I think most historians have covered the least, is that women resisted the American plan at every stage in this history. Women, as you said, rioted. They would do something called smashing out, where they would break every window in a detention facility. They would physically assault their captors. A surprising number of American planned institutions caught fire because the inmates were committing arson as an act of resistance. Hundreds, probably thousands of women escaped. And then, at least several hundred women sued the government to try to win their freedom. All of these things were acts of resistance. But I also make clear that, women who were released, who simply continued to live their lives, to have sex and to date who they want, those were also acts of resistance. So in overt and in covert ways, women constantly resisted the American plan. And in the 1960s and 70s, that resistance actually began to pay dividends. Women who launched resistance campaigns in New York and in San Francisco in the 60s and 70s actually succeeded in ceasing enforcement of American plan laws in those cities. So it really was the activism of the women on the ground that was the most salient method for opposing the American plan.
Yeah, that is a very inspiring thing to hear. And that's, the people on the ground are the ones that are always going to change these draconian laws. It's not going
that's
to
right.
come from the top down.
So right.
Your book recently was an option to become a movie, I heard, right?
Yeah, that is true.
Does that seem like that's going to, is it just in the optioning phase? Do you have anyone that's stepped up that's looking to direct it yet, or?
Yeah, so I mean, the vast majority of things that get optioned don't ultimately become movies. So at this point, it's still just a dream, but it's a couple steps closer. We have a wonderful producer who's won an Oscar. We have a really amazing screenwriter who theoretically any day now should be getting me a copy of the script. And then once we have the script, we'll start sending it out to actors and to directors, and hopefully the project will keep moving forward. But at this point, it's just kind of a really exciting dream.
I think it might happen. This is the time.
Hopefully.
There's a lot of things going on in the world
That's
now
right.
that make this seem more relevant than it may have ever been before. So. Even though, I wish it wasn't
totally.
True, your timing may be perfect with this book coming out.
Hey, that's yeah. pretty true.
Unfortunately. Mm-hmm. So, what do you have going on in the near future? Do you have any, book signings? How can people get in touch with you? How can people get your book?
Well, so I had a bunch of book signings over the last couple weeks. I was all over the East Coast. I'm pretty much done with that for now, although I think we're going to add some, especially maybe on the West Coast in a little bit, so I'll keep you updated. I am, however, going to be on the American Scholars podcast in the next couple days. You can read excerpts of the book in the Washington Post or in Time if you just Google it. They ran a little bit ago. And of course, you can get the book all over the place. You can find it at your local independent bookstore or in a big bookstore. You can find it on Amazon or on IndieBound or really anywhere where books are sold. And if you want to get in touch with me, I'd love to talk about this. Reaching out on Twitter is a really effective way. I always respond, and I'd love to talk to people about this book.
Yeah, it sounds like something you're really passionate about and managed to, just a passing comment from a professor definitely shaped into a fascinating book, and this information should be gotten out and everyone should know about this. This is not information that should be hidden. We've made a lot of mistakes in this country's history, and we cannot brush them under the rug. We have to make sure that these mistakes are not repeated again.
I totally agree. I couldn't agree more. And I really thank you for having me on here to spread the word, to talk about this.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I really appreciate it. And to my listeners, thank you guys for listening tonight. If you like this kind of reporting, stories you're not hearing everywhere else, leftist media, anti-capitalist, we need your help. We're still just young here at New Jersey Revolution Radio. Make sure you go on to our website, NJ Revolution Radio, click on like, donate to us. We're on Patreon. You can donate right through the website. You can follow us on SoundCloud, on Twitter, on Google Play, on Stitcher, all those places. Anything you do to help us out, we really appreciate it. If you have stories for us, reach out to us at info@njrevolutionradio.com. And the future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.